Mr. Gormley, Reel 19. You were talking about that particular event, action.
So we're in this place in we've got into this camp of jailer, and we're better down there for the night, as I say, and then the next day we moved out of there and went up to this place called BC Cascai. And we're under fire most of the way. And we got there, we wanted to go to the money to keep their heads down like and going, and we settled down there for the night. And still under fire. And then we decided the next day that there was no way they could get forward because the terrain was so rough. Just big jumbles of rocks right, left and centre. There was no way we could get up the damn hill camp to force them through. So they decided there was only the battalion of the Argyles and us had gone forward on this particular hill, and those had been left in the Yale camp. So we said, right, that's it, get back to Yale. So we scuttered back, a lot of us, and we all got back into the Yale camp that night. And I thought, that's it. But we felt reasonably safe there. And we're sitting there, as I say, like we're always gunpoint in different ways, so that we have complete control of the camp. And all of a sudden, this has been about 1 o'clock in the morning or something like that, maybe earlier. He shouted, "To the walls, to the walls, everyone to the walls!" And we were coming over the bloody wire. The place, we had about 100 yards of dunnet wire, what they call dunnet wire. It's an awful stuff to get across, you know. And they actually crawled across the top of the thing, putting really old chartboys, old beds, carpets, and they crawled over the top of the lot. And they were on the bloody walls, they were on the walls, they come up to the walls, and they were actually fighting on the walls. And even though the order came off, like, three men on the gun, the rest of the walls. And I'll tell you what I did, there's two of them sitting there. I didn't have time to go and get my bloody bond up, which was left away from the guns altogether. I grabbed a bloody axe off them, a bloody big woodman's axe on the side of the gun. You always carry it like that. We're putting camouflage and that, you know. And I grabbed that axe from his bush. And I went to the walls with a bloody axe, a bloody big chopper axe. I said, "No, could they get me?" And I'm pretty flailing with this bloody axe, and everybody was away from it on the side. There's a couple of sea boys here and a couple of sea boys up there, and I'm flailing this bloody thing round my head. And
Did you hit anyone with it?
Yes.
No, you actually, yes, I hit them. So you got as close as that to them?
I was as close as that to them, I'm not kidding. I mean, I'm not joking about it or anything like that. And it wasn't until the rule in the fight and this young sea boy that was being sat beside us, you know, like alongside us, he'd been killed. And his rifle and his bandolier had dropped, like, you know. And so, no, it was my chance, and I grabbed his bloody bandolier, which is where a bandolier, and then this. I grabbed his bloody mandolin and I grabbed his rifle and I started firing with a bloody rifle. But until then, I hadn't had time to do anything else but fight with that bloody axe.
And what were they armed with?
They were rotten rifles and things. You know, they all had their own rifles, carried their own rifles. They all had a hell of a shot, they were great marksmen. And they went on with it.
Were they old fashioned rifles or up to date modern rifles?
A lot of them were. But they could make the old-fashioned men, and they could hit you about 800 yards away, you fucking motor. Marvellous shot.
Presumably you did drive them off, they
were... Oh, yeah, well, as I say, it got to about 4:30 in the morning, and then they started retreating. And while this had been going on there, there'd been a hell of a lot of fire coming out of this big graveyard that was at the bottom, where the big... Waziristan graveyard there. The daddy had all saddled up in there. The Argyles lost quite a few men, and the Indians, I mean, I just saw the British pictures and that going past, you know. I was only, as I say, about half past four in the morning, they just tailed away. And they took all the dead with them. They didn't leave any dead behind. They took them all with them.
So called into action like that, was this your first really severe action?
I've never been into any action before. So not a full action, right? You know, not that. I mean, there, I was fighting for my bloody life. I had to, I couldn't do any other. No, you're sitting down in jail, like. I was actually fighting for my bloody life. And I've been in many heavy situations since the war, or during the war, I should say. I've never run as highly as that. And I've been in a lot of very situations since then. And I've never been in more than that.
And it's a question of...
I was only a young, impressionable soldier at the time. Made a hell of an impression on me, I'll tell you.
And it is a question of survival, fighting, you know, for your own survival.
Definitely, yeah.
And in a sense, does your civilized way go away? You're just, what, an animal fighting?
No, you're like an animal. You're like an animal. It's the old saying, it's you or them. Yeah, you or them.
Afterwards, what's the immediate reaction when it's all over? To yourself, you know, personally, what was your immediate reaction to this?
Deflation. Just like that. Just comes in there, sinks into what you've done. You never stop to think of what you've done to people, you know, what it does. Comes in. Can't do any other, you know. Sitting there, oh God, I shouldn't have done that, eh? But you did, you had to do it, you know, if you hadn't done it,
Is it a tiredness come over? Do you want to sleep or eat or drink when you finish?
I never felt tired at all. In fact, I was more wide awake that particular night than I ever really was very late. I mean, your mind just won't accept it. You know, your mind just won't accept what you've actually done. You know. All right. And then anyway, we came back from there because it was useless. In there, and we went back to Gary Home camp again, and that was where, yes, that's right, because they relieved the Argyles, because they had quite a thousand, like, all the, I mean, not only this battle, but they'd been in a lot longer before I ever got there, they'd been doing this thing, you know. So they were relieved by the Green Howards. They came up and came alongside us in the camp at Gary Home. And we got there, and things had quietened down a bit there. And, there was one little incident that happened there in Gary Home camp. They had this picket out on the sangar, like I was telling about the big sangar that was built on the top of the hilltop. And the greenhouses had taken up there. And what you used to do there, whenever you were in these sangas, you used to take the soapy water that we were using to wash with, because you carried everything up with you, you know, and the water that you used to wash in, you used to take it down the hillside and throw it down the hillside, because it's nothing, in a heat like that, you know, you've nothing worse than pretty soapy water lying about where you're living and breathing and eating and that, you know. So it was always endemic that you took everything up down the bloody hillside, away from the sangar altogether. And this young lad, hadn't been up there long, because I'd already been up there about 4 or 5 months by then, and he hadn't been up there long, and he'd gone out to throw his water down the hillside, and he got shot in the leg. Well, one of his favourites, but he shot him in the leg. And by the time they got him down, like, gangrene had set in, and of course they took his leg off. And when they inquired of this young subaltern that was in charge of them, and the silly bugger, instead of saying what he should have said, he said the wrong thing. He said, well, where was he when this happened? He said he was on the countryside throwing his water down the hill. He was outside the bloody barbed wire, wasn't he? So he never got a pension. He got bugged all, he lost a leg, and never got a pension. They were like that in those days.
And the officer hadn't realised this and could have said that he was inside or whatever.
All they had to do was say he was throwing the water, so they threw the wire down the side. But he said he was outside the wire. Told him he was outside the wire. When word come back that his pension had been refused because he'd been outside the wire. It's unbelievable, it's bloody true. So, unbelievable, actually true. He actually, bloody, God. I said, he'll not last me, he won't either. Oh, they never do. They've only got to sleep one night that night, you know.
How did you get on with the other units in this camp?
Oh, we were on with them. They
tend to be pretty hard drinkers.
And the Gurkhas, we used to drink the white attic, the room, white room, they used to drink.
The Gurkhas?
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, the most honest people in the world, the Gurkhas. Honest, I mean that. You see, I mean, I know this for a fact because this fella, what I call him, Richie. Bombardier Richie. If I could come back to my mind, I never thought about it for years. Bombardier Richie. He got out something up with these girls, you know, and then he flaked out like, you know, drinking this white woman. They weren't used to it, you couldn't help it. And they flaked him out. These two Gurkhas came back, brought them back, actually, to the tambour that we were in, where we were built, like, you see where you're at? Bombardier Richie's shop. Right, give them away, I said, have you got this? Oh, no, I said, we've taken everything out of his pockets, we'll bring it back tomorrow. He said, oh, you know. I said, you're bringing it back tomorrow. I said, give it to me. No. We bring it back tomorrow. And you know why? Because they didn't trust the bloody Englishman that they wouldn't pinch you bloody money.
They'd bring it back to him when he was sober.
Brought it back and give it to him.
What about the Indian soldiers that were there? Did you get on well with those?
Oh, yes. Well, I think, irrespective of who you are, if you're serving with anybody, you get on well with them. You've got to, you know, because they're the same as you. They're exactly the same as we are, you know, as regards fighting men. Right? Yeah, that's all you ask, a fighting man to be a fighting man, you know.
And they were good soldiers, these good Indians, soldiers. Were they?
Oh, these were the ones I'm talking about. You've got the Johnny Gurkha, you had the Gawali, the Frontier Scouts, the Touchy Scouts, Frontier Force Rifles. That's what they were made for, that's what they were built for, to do this work up there, like, you know. But you always had to have an English battalion with them, just to steady them. Yeah. So, then we came from there, we went down to...
How long were you there at this camp?
With the greenhouse, about a couple of months. And then we'll go down doing these often heads of patrols. Yeah. Still getting really shot at wherever you went. You got shot at wherever you went, didn't matter. And we went from there to, we left the Green Howards there, and we went down to this Dandil camp that I talked about.
What date would this be?
This be in 1937. Yeah, about July, maybe, when we went to Dandil. And we went out with these, with the Gurkhas. The Gurkha rifle, mind the texture when they keep it, catch these bubbles, I tell you. And we went out with this lot, and we ran into another storm of bloody trident. And come the end of the day, we lost three men. And that was bad enough for us, like, you know, long way to say, but yeah. But we lost three men. The Gurkhas had lost 14 men and about 20 wounded. It takes some to do that with a bloody Gurkha, I'll tell you, the face of Little Wallace left. And I'll never forget it, like, because they brought all the men back, Well, everybody back there had been killed and that, and then the wounded were sent up to the main hospital at Rasbach, and they just built this pretty big funeral pyre, about as big as this room, the logs and that. And I'd never seen anything like that in my life before. And I put all the bloody bodies in there doing that. What the bloody hell are they going to do? I'm going to cremate them, and he said, this is what they do. And I go, yeah, they cremated them there and then, just outside the camp. Built this pretty big fire and burned a bloody lot of them. And that night, there wasn't a soul of the Gurkhas left in the camp. It was supposed to be confined to the camp. And look, we were all doing bloody shanty going. And the next morning, they all come bloody marching in, bloody grinning all over their faces, you know. It was thinking, and a string of bloody ears tied on the belt. All bloody ears. And Adam had a string on the belt, run off the side of the belt. I said, what the bloody hell? I said, what the hell? That's what he said. Oh, he said, the more ears they've got, when they get back to Nepal, he said, the bigger the water, the bigger the body they are, and the more money they get off the king of Nepal. He said, that's why they take the ears off. They've got to take them back and show them, and prove them that they were. I was learning all the time, you know. And I bloody hell.
Was this camp that you're now in on the same model as the one you had before?
More or less the same thing, only it was a much flatter plain where we were. We were like more or less on a flat ground there. We weren't like up in the valley and took down anything. Coming down from that Gary Owen camp, as I said before, it took us about 6 miles to come down. And there was actually sheer drops of over 2,000 feet just going down like that, like a pretty knife edge. You know, and it was unbelievable. And you come down, you said, put the bucket in the auxiliary low gear, and that was the lowest gear you could get, and he would come down there all the way, like that, and he wouldn't take it out of gear until he got to the bottom. And it was the same when you were going up, you stuck it in the auxiliary gear, you didn't want to be changing down halfway up, like it, you just stuck it in there and it just came all the way up, like, you know. Oh, okay.
And did you bring your own guns out or leave them in for another unit to take over?
Oh, no, we brought our own guns out.
And another unit would take their guns in?
Yeah. Well, there was a little things that happened there. Oh, yeah, that one just come to my mind there, aye. This Paddy Hunter, come from Beamish, you know. Funny, I can always remember his address, 6 Thornton Village, Beamish. And, 6 Thornton Village, Beamish, Paddy Hunter. Yeah, I don't know where I got the name Paddy from, like, he's a Geordie born and bred, like, you know. So, we were out with this big league one this year. And we were out, like, it was a touchy scout. And all of a sudden, Paddy gets close with this VB gun. You
know? What's a VB gun?
Vickers Bertha. Vickers Bertha gun. It's water cooled. Because it used to have a piston slide. And it's the only way, if you start a fire, you had to have water ready to pour on the piston slide to keep it running, otherwise it would have bloody just seized up. And this was before Ben guns and that. And he's firing at this bloody clump of trees way up on the bloody hillside, you know. And this hole of us come dashing up. He says, what the hell are you firing at? He said, in the trees up there, I've seen somebody moving, man. Something moving up there, he said. Pretty funny, that old butler, like, can't help but laugh like that. He says, something moving up there, and you've told us to be careful that we've got to fire at anything we see, like, he said, anything suspicious. Well, there's something suspicious up there, he said. So, but he said, right, he said, Sergeant, take 6 men and go up that bloody hill, talk to me, Bucky Reynolds and Penny Palmer, Peddler Palmer, and 6 of us were charging up this Sunday, bloody person of my hands, you know, we didn't know what to expect, like, we had charging up this bloody hill, we would be in this picture, and every bloody thing, and it was as tough as scouts as we were on the bloody hill, like, we were charging up this charged up there, and even when he, one of these machines to be there and throw dead camels.
It must have been quite. Moving out like that on these patrols must have been quite stressful, in the sense that any movement anywhere could have meant a bullet in
you. He was quite right in what he did. You see, he saw a movement in the trees, and it could have been anything like a bloody dead cow.
Each of these camps would have a medical unit in it.
Oh yes, you always carried your own FAD, first aid. You always carry your own first aid with you. Yeah. I was already trained. I'd been sent John Thomas.
Would there be a doctor in the camp and presumably a medical staff?
Oh yes, you had your own medical staff. You carried your own medical staff with you.
Any other memories of this particular camp before we move on?
No, I don't think so. It wasn't long after that, like, say, probably about the August, I think, that when the 5th Regiment Royal Artillery, they came up and relieved us, and we took all our guns and everything, and we made our way back to our own camp in Lausanne.
And you were back to the one that you started in there for the 10 days. And what were you doing there when you got there?
Well, we were back in, when we got back to Lausanne, of course, we were back to the old, the same old thing, you know, guards, sent to go, etc., etc. And it was very, you can't describe the difference from being up on the front here in the mountains and that, to when you got back onto the plains at Nowshera. Because that Nowshera was the second most humid place in the world. There was only one place that had more humidity than the Kabul Basin. That's fact, that. Quickly. And that is the Grand Canyon in Colorado. Mm-hmm.
Did this affect your health?
Oh God, yes. You sweated day and night. Irrespective of the pumpkins or anything like that, you just sweated day and night. Day and night. You've got prickly heat, and that's the most awful thing when you get it. Oh, God. And you had prickly heat and all that. You went on prayed at 5 o'clock. Instead of 6, and he came off at 10. He went back on parade at 4 o'clock, and he did the rest of his duties. Time in between, siesta time, he went and he lay on his bed, and he just lay there, or did whatever he wanted to do, like, you know. But yeah, and it's the only place in my life that I've ever known. The British Army, in those days, anyway, I mean, they might have changed a bit since then, like, because of all the things that. But at that time, which was a regular army depot, and from 10 o'clock onwards, there was a fan on that veranda for the guard, and the guard was given a table to sit at. And the only time he got to his feet was if an officer drove past for it all. Brigadier or somebody came past that he recognised, and God help him if he didn't recognise him, because he would be straight in and put on a bloody charge if he didn't get to his feet and salute, you know. But that fan was blown all day, every day, with an electric fan on the table beside you, like the only thing to disturb the air around you. And he just sat there, and with his rifle beside you, like, and it's, you could see it there, you know, it was a big main road going down, you know, all you had to do was a big jumpy face, give a salam like, and then back down. And no, you never did anything during the day, not a thing,
So it was a basic army camp. Now, you know, you did all the drills and the polishing and so forth.
Yes. Just a few miles away, the Duke of Gloucester was with the 65th Lancers at a place called Risenfleur. Then the Peugeot garrison was only 12 miles away. And you had all these, you had sporting engagements with all these people round about you, and the Gurkhas, they were there as well. And they used to play them all, the Gurkhas used to play in bare feet. If we kick the ball harder with a bare feet than we could with a pair of boots on. You know, and we found many things to occupy. It was always, you know, surprisingly things.
Did you get out of camp into the townships at all? Or
yes, you could walk up. You just used to walk up. And you could go. And you used to barter. You barter for everything. You didn't. If he said 10 rupees, you'd look at him and say, 10 rupees, 5, or even less. You know what you thought it was worth, and you would barter and barter and barter, and you'd turn away and walk away. We'd call you back and got a little bit more up, you know. And you got used to doing it, and we used to enjoy it, actually. But they would never sell you anything that hadn't already made a profit on. But they wouldn't sell it, they wouldn't say, well, give us 10 rupees for that. Because if you took that 10 rupees, it's bloody dead easy, you know. So you learned how to barter. You barter for everything.
But it was a safe area for you to move around, was it?
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. There was always these loose walls floating about, as I said. You used to pinch your kit and you used to go up and you would look round till you found your kit, but you had your own name and number, etc. on, and give them 2 pence or 5 pence or whatever, you know, and you'd get it back. And then you'd go back and there'd be somebody else to turn the next day, kind of stuff. There was a tragic thing that happened there with a lad, a young welterweight boxer. He'd been constipated, and he'd probably been for a few days without realizing. There was one thing you couldn't afford to be in there with the heat. And by the time he got to the hospital, they couldn't shift him. And when they had the inquest, they told us how it happened. They said it was bloody baked hard inside him like that. They couldn't move it. There was nowhere to put it. And it was a lovely, lovely, good, welterweight doctor. And come from Birmingham. Come back to your mind here. I was just talking about it. And he came from Birmingham. Lovely, fresh up and that. You know, beautiful boxer. And of course he died. And we had to try to go up and give him the top of the real lake, you know. And the thing was there, the whole of that area, all the way around, was lush green grass, beautiful grass, and even the plain fields and everything, were all grass, well covered and everything. At 70, it was just sand. From there onwards, it was just sand. I'll never forget that, because we buried him in bloody sand. And yet, with all that green grass and everything, which was irrigated from the dunes, and that's just exactly where the irrigation stopped.
Were there any ladies? Were there servicemen or families there?
They were all married quarters. Oh, they all had all the married quarters, you see, and a lot of the sergeants and inspectors and some of the gunners, I think, they were all in married quarters. And of course, the officers, they were nearly all, most of the officers were married. In fact, one of them, Parker, I think it's called him, James Parker. Not Ginger Parker. It was a gingery fella. He was married to one of the Woolworth heiresses. He married into money, didn't he? He had one of the Woolworth heiresses he was married to.